us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sesti. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. As the Israeli regime continues to break its ceasefire agreements in both Gaza and Lebanon, anti-occupation leaders reiterate that resistance is the only way to confront Zionist aggression. What happens when guarantors of the agreements are also part of the problem? Do the Israelis want full-scale wars again? Well, the Secretary General of Hezbollah says surrender is never an option. And the resistance will not disarm. What lies ahead for the region? Stay with us as we take a look at this on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Zeid Marchand, international law expert and geopolitical analyst out of Geneva. And Batu Sabeti, activist and political analyst out of London. Well, thank you both for being with us. Let's start it off in London. And Batul, the Israeli regime is currently breaking two ceasefire agreements. I mean, do you think that this is overall part of the regime's strategy to basically agree to the ceasefires in hopes that global attention to its crimes would become less, while at the same time continuing with its killings?
Yes, good evening to you, Marzia, and to your guests and all your viewers. It's not necessary that the policy of the Israeli occupation entity is necessarily matching that of America. At the end of the day, it is America that imposed the ceasefire in both countries, and the Israeli occupation entity, as we know, it wishes to move as it wills, and we see that effectively the ceasefire is not a reality in both Lebanon and in Gaza, in the sense that it's continuously being broken. And actually, the Israeli occupation entity is emboldened in many ways because it knows that right now, in this current phase, the resistance will not per se enter into a direct open war with it, because it's not in its interests to do so, as it is restructuring and recuperating itself in what is now just one pit stop within a much broader and longer battle in this region to ultimately liberate it. So I believe that the Americans support a kind of negotiation under fire. That's their current strategy right now. It is one of closing the direct open wars. Without necessarily having that open war, it wants to achieve what could not be achieved, essentially, within 2 years of direct open war, whether that's in Gaza or, as we know, last year in Lebanon for those 66 days. So the Israeli occupation entity is fulfilling its interests to a minimum extent at a time in which it knows that the resistance won't respond. But ultimately, Israel cannot go outside of the American dictates in causing an all-out war. If it wants to do that, then it has to get the American position ultimately. And we've been seeing a series of escalations since the ceasefire last year on the 27th of November. We saw the peak of the escalation that occurred last month with the assassination of the chief of staff of the resistance in Lebanon. And it must be said that the resistance right now, its lack of response shouldn't be mistaken as its lack of a willingness to respond to the entity. Ultimately, it's preparing for something much greater, and that's for the next war, and that won't be like this current war. And I believe, you know, this current phase is about, you know, closing these direct open wars and not opening new ones.
So, Batu, are you saying basically that the ceasefire was forced upon the Israeli regime by the Americans, and right now the Americans have given them a way that they can basically continue their aggression, but having the other side abide by the ceasefire? Or what exactly are you saying there?
Right. So what I'm saying is there's a limit to the extent in which Israel transgresses. So America is happy with Israel transgressing as long as there's no reaction from the other side. But ultimately, it is playing with fire here, because is what constitutes an aggression so large, such as to start a direct open war. So there's a tipping point. America's ideal is negotiations under fire. It wants to pressure the resistance and get the resistance to a point of disarmament where Israel failed to do so through a direct open war. And that is to turn the government in Lebanon against the resistance. But it's quite hard to do so, or let's say the Lebanese government doesn't exactly have the argument to do so when Israel's transgressions are so ongoing and continuing. So there's a certain tipping point over here, but what's clear is that Israel, through its direct open wars, both in Gaza and Lebanon, has failed to achieve what its primary goal was, and that's to disarm the resistance and achieve this quote-unquote new Middle East project. So that has clearly failed. America's thinking, what is the next option? Let's assess new strategies, and that's to turn it into an internal front. So in Gaza, it's to get the International Stabilization Force to disarm the resistance in Gaza, to locate the tunnels, to restructure the PA. Essentially, where Israel failed, it's to get the internal fronts to carry out that dirty work.
All right. Well, I'm going to stay with you, Batou. I'm waiting for Sayed Moaz to join us. I mean, when we look at Batou, well, Sayed Moaz, I have you. Can you hear me? Okay. I think we're still having some audio difficulties. Sayed Moaz, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear
you. Okay. I saw a nodding of the head, so that was a good sign. Thanks so much for joining us. When we look at the overall situation that is taking place, whether we're talking about in Gaza or we're talking about in Lebanon, we get to the point we have those guarantors of the ceasefires. How complicit, Sayed Moaz, do you see these guarantors? What should they be doing and what is not happening right now as the Israeli aggression continues in both places?
Well, thank you for having me. Sorry for that technical difficulty earlier. The thing is, you know, these guarantors need to be able to do the basics, and sometimes they're not even able to do that. And that's what brings a lot of this question into these ceasefires and why some commentators have, again, called it you cease and I will continue to fire. And that's how Israel has changed the development around there. I just came from Doha Forum where this was being discussed. And, you know, there never was a time to discuss about humanitarian aid and access to humanitarian aid as a conversation piece in negotiations. This was supposed to be something that's given anyways. The fact that you have guarantors that are discussing this as a potential negotiating piece clearly shows the one-levelness on this side in favor of Israel. There should be no question as to these basic humanitarian needs. And so what guarantee can we get from people who are negotiating humanitarian access? This is really appalling to begin with, the starting point. And if you even knew the British scholar who actually put the design for this, they're apparently using his playbook. He even came out and condemned America and saying that this is incorrect to use it in this manner. So even the academics and the people in the international community who are working in humanitarian affairs clearly see what these deals are for. They're never in reality for what they're supposed to be, which is ceasefire. They don't have the basics of even that. So the guarantors are one-sided. We do not have parties to this these agreements or these ceasefires that want a serious end to the violence and to put serious restrictions on Israel, who happens to be the main person in this entire either ceasefire in Gaza or in Lebanon that seems to be violating that. And what are the consequences of that? That's something that the guarantors have to show, the consequences that Israel will get as a result of violating these ceasefires.
Well, let's talk about that. Staying with you, Sayed Moaz, the consequences. I mean, so far, we haven't seen the consequences, but at the same time, people continue to be killed, both in Gaza and Lebanon. Let me also add to that the West Bank even. So what are the consequences? And at the end of the day, if there are no consequences, then tell me about what exactly it means to have these type of agreements and the guarantors.
I hate to sound very bleak, but that your question is very a striking one, and that's something that us academics, we're really looking at into now. I mean, for example, this idea of lack of humanitarian access to these locations by the Israeli authorities is essentially genocidal intent. Amnesty International came out last month with a very brazen report suggesting that just because it's a ceasefire, the continued prevention of humanitarian aid access to people in need is a genocidal intent. And that's what it is. Israel is in this Eretz Israel project. They want to take over this entire area. Netanyahu has been Smotrich and others who have his allies, they make it very clear that this is what they want. Now, what sort of consequences? I mean, in the Amnesty International report, for example, they're talking about bringing ICC charges, which we know have already happened with Netanyahu and Gallant, but so far no real meaningful action. I mean, just right now, the ICC had a gathering in which they're seeking the support. Some of their judges have been sanctioned. I just met Francesca Albanese. I mean, can you imagine a UN rapporteur who's just reporting the truth has gets sanctioned and she has difficulty just functioning basics? So there are a few of us who are obviously in the international humanitarian affairs, human rights, but again, countries have to step up, and particularly Muslim countries who seem to have gone toe-in-toe with Mr. Trump. This is great, okay, but you need to be able to push back and get some serious guarantees. And if you cannot get guarantees of basic human rights, basic humanitarian access, the prevention of continued warfare, which Israel continues to do, this is not a ceasefire. This is a continuance of war.
Well, Batul, what does it mean? I mean, as a previous guest said, it's a continuation of war. It sounds good. People are talking about possibilities and of course, that there should be guarantees to allow the humanitarian supplies to enter. But at the same time, as we're speaking, people continually, they're dying. They're being killed. They're being starved to death in Gaza. I mean, the head of Hamas, Khalil al-Hayya, has said that armed resistance and bearing arms remains the right of the Palestinian struggle against the Zionist occupation, obviously stressing that resistance is the only way, and they will not lay down their weapons. I mean, your thought about that comment at this point in time, who was it meant for, and what does it mean exactly in your perspective?
Absolutely. This is the line of resistance, and that is where there is occupation. Resisting is an inherent right. In fact, international law gives that very right, and it's a very natural phenomenon that actually there is a spontaneous reaction to every action. So that is a given right that occurs naturally within the phenomenon of nature's power even, and that's every action leads to a kind of reaction. So when the extent of the permissibility of practicing aggression and committing atrocities, as you've just mentioned, and actually the complete transgression on every human rights occurs, it's very natural to see this kind of resistance, and the legitimacy of that resistance is garnered due to the very action of the enemy. So what if you have every kind of aggression, occupation, and complete transgression combined? You know, so it is not natural for there to be no resistance, you know, based on the extent of the transgression that we're seeing. But you mentioned the superpowers over here and the guarantors. Ultimately, what matters to them in all of this is not securing the rights of the people or their state of being or the allowing of international aid or any of that. What matters to them is for the region, ultimately, to suit their interests. So right now, they don't want it to turn into an open war. They don't want major instability right now. They let Israel do what it wants right now within that certain limit that we've described, and that is that Israel's targeting of resistance targets in Lebanon should be such that it doesn't go beyond select targets and lead to an open war, because ultimately they want these negotiations to continue whilst under pressure. So it's negotiations under fire. And the guarantors of the ceasefire, US and France, absolutely play no role in safeguarding the rights of the people. In fact, it's the opposite. They allow Israel to do what it wants without opposing. I mean, Tom Barak said this clearly with one word. That is, we cannot and do not wish to pressure Israel. Same words of Lindsey Graham. He went to the extent of saying, even if the resistance in Lebanon is disarmed, we cannot control Israel, i.e. it can do whatever it wants. It can turn even into a Syria model where you negotiate concessions are given, all the concessions of the world. You do exactly what Israel wants, but at the same time, we can target every weapons depot in the country and completely strip away your sovereignty and maintain our very presence and occupy your land, essentially. So that means that there's been zero adherence, the complete opposite of what the US claims. It's backing and justifying everything Israel can do, and we know with the press of a button, it can stop Israel from its actions. Worse than that, what Israel does, its attacks for Lebanon is being used as a pressure against Lebanon to do what Israel failed to do. So if Israel failed to disarm the resistance, then the Israeli attacks are used to pressure Lebanon to get it to disarm via the government. And we know that the resistance has given its weapons south of the Litani. That's something that the Secretary General has come out and said and reaffirmed the statements from the UN to that effect. So the guarantors turn things from an all-out war to negotiations under fire. That's essentially what we're seeing right now in the region compared to the status quo before, and that is all because an open war did not reach its goals, and that is because the resistance, may I add, is still strong, aka it's not been defeated.
All right. Well, Said Maaz, Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sheikh Naim Qassem, has said that, talking to the Lebanese, that those who are helping the enemy to look at what has happened to Syria and understand what the enemy wants for Lebanon, which is an entity under direct Israeli control and destruction of Lebanon. Your thoughts, what can the Lebanese, what should the Lebanese learn from Syria?
No, absolutely. I think that's well said, that they're going to occupy a piece of Lebanon. Let's not beat around the bush about it. That's exactly the plan. That is Eretz Israel. That is working towards Eretz Israel. And that's something that's been very clear from the Israeli agenda. So Lebanese people, look at their country for the last time with those borders, because that southern part of that border, Israel is going to take. And then once they eat that, they're going to eat the rest, and it's going to be a continuous process, which has been going on since 70 years, ever since this Zionist project has been allowed to flourish in this area. Now, that's exactly what's happening in Syria, where they've taken over this land, and they're not going to give it back. This idea, and they're using this idea of one minority playing it against another minority. And this is the strategy that Israel's been used. Over there, they've supported the Christian minorities or the Druze communities, where in actuality, those Druze were the very first people to be part of the rebels. So it's kind of just using one party to another and to get their ends to meet. And Lebanese people need to realize that, you know, you have to come together. This is the defense and sovereignty of your nation. And what's really sad is that, what I think is very, a point that, you know, my colleague mentioned, Batul, is about the resistance. Let's be clear here. Hezbollah goes away today. Hamas goes away today. The resistance is not going to end. Because the issues behind why the resistance exists, those inequities, will still exist, and people will raise their banner to resist against the Israeli Zionist project. And that's something that that people need to realize, that that's not going to happen. And just one last point before you continue is that what we see out of Europe when we talk about you regionally, look what they're doing to Russia. I mean, they unilaterally just froze all the assets of the Russians just last week, right? And a ceasefire hasn't even occurred. So, I mean, when we talk about tools that are available for these very countries, we talk about, oh, we support Palestine, we recognize Palestine, it's time to actually do more. And you are doing it in certain cases for Ukraine, and this sort of hypocrisy and double standard is actually clearly destroying the international legal framework as we know it today. So, for God's sakes, please stop doing that. And for Muslim countries to step up and follow pursuit, because this is our region. The Arab countries need to come together and realize that just like regionally EU is dealing with the Ukrainian issue, the Arab countries need to come together more solidly and give a quiet response that we're not going to do business with Israel. Those who've signed Abrahamic Accords, pull back their ambassadors and those agreements until we get some serious feedback. So there are things that practically can happen and will do if they have the backbone to do that. That's the big thing.
Yeah, that's the big question. But Batul, I mean, Sheikh Naim Qassem has reiterated that Hezbollah defends and will persevere and stand firm. And surrender, he says, leaves nothing. Resistance opened the path to possibilities. I mean, your thoughts on these statements, and in general, your overall prognosis of what lies ahead for the Lebanese resistance, and in general, Lebanon right now, with a very, very volatile situation right now. Your thoughts?
Yes, absolutely. Essentially, what Sheikh Naim over here is saying is that the resistance presence should really be considered for the government a source of strength, and needs to be added to this will of the government that seeks sovereignty and stability. So effectively, where there is a vacuum, and let's be real, the Lebanese government is unable to deter Israeli aggression because the Lebanese government is unable to arm itself in a way where it can defend its sovereignty, because America, it controls the dictates and it does not allow. So suppose tomorrow the Lebanese government was to take hold of the resistance weapons, we will see a similar situation as of Syria, and that is the Israeli occupation entity will rain down its explosions across those weapons depots. So basically, Lebanon, under the American terms of dictates, is not allowed to be sovereign, and this is where the resistance comes in, and it basically fills the gaps. because diplomacy, as we see it right now, is not being used as a tool for liberation, as it should be. That is a tool to realize Lebanon's sovereignty. Rather, diplomacy is being used to blackmail the Lebanese state to give up the resistance arms and strip it of its sovereignty. So what the resistance is trying to do is to prevent the government from giving up its core interests of sovereignty, as it claims that that is an interest, and really to join it so that it can be a supporting front in fighting this Israeli aggression. As we know, Israel didn't dare to enter Lebanon for the past 24 years, except in 2006, in which it got a heavy bashing. So resistance is necessary. And ultimately, the situation that we see in Lebanon, as far as the supportive, nurturing environment of the resistance, is that never in any time has it ever been as determined and steadfast in its commitment to the path of resistance as it is today. You have the residents of the destroyed borders who, as we speak, are literally living in caravans instead of homes because they cannot afford to rebuild and the reconstruction is not underway. But despite everything, their movement and life has not stopped. They continue to revive their areas, to harvest their crops, to cling to their lands. This kind of steadfastness and attachment to the land, this deep sense of belonging, would not exist without their commitment to the cause and adherence to the path.
Okay.
So those who live among them can sense how deeply they are connected to their land and understand the concept of resistance and how that has transformed into a way of life. And I believe that is the biggest fear for the Israeli occupation entity and America. It's
all
not
right,
the
stay, stay with me, Batu, because I only have one minute. So sorry, Sedmois, 1 minute. I mean, your overall thoughts about where are we headed in the region with the Israeli aggression and assassinations and destruction continuing. We look at Palestine, we look at Lebanon, the region. Your thoughts?
I mean, you know, just in a nutshell, Israeli Zionist project, it's not checked. And, you know, and these Europeans are complaining about mass migration and now looking to alternative solutions and save third countries. Well, guess what? There's going to be millions of Palestinians on your door, millions of Syrians, millions of Lebanese. If you keep staying on the back foot, you need to step up and be able to do the same actions you're so-called doing in this conflict with Ukraine and Russia on Israel to get some serious, serious action. And Muslim countries, you have an obligation as fellow Muslims. I mean, and that in itself is enough to do something in which to reject these Abrahamic Accords.
Okay.
And those who have signed off to step out from it. That's when you can put true pressure on Israel. Otherwise, they're just going to run over the whole region, Lebanon today and tomorrow somewhere else.
And on that note, thank you both for being with me. Sedmois Shah, international law expert, geopolitical analyst out of Geneva, Batu Sobeiti, activist and political analyst out of London. Thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Good morning to all listeners from around the world. You are tuned into Iran Radio. It's very nice to have you with us. We start this hour's lineup with our radio productions feature. Dialogue will be next. The program looks at the most important conversation between Shiite imams and their followers, questioners, and leaders of other Islamic faith and sects. That will be followed by Ulema's speech. In this program, we broadcast excerpts from the speeches of well-known and reputable Islamic scholars. Our varied radio productions feature will be our final program this hour.
I guess I get so furious when people think it's anti-Semitic and that Palestinians are walking around as just raging anti-Semites in the desert. So much of the Palestinian cause and everything I've engaged with is deeply aware of everything you just said. They know the trauma of the Jew really, really, like, intimately.
Right.
And they perversely also have come to know that they are its victim of that trauma. And in my reading, maybe this is just too nice, I've been incredibly patient with bearing the brunt of a lot of that sort of
that
anger for some time. But it seems that maybe it's over. Maybe the clock is ticking on that. You know which poem I'm actually referencing now, which is the what is it? I will eat my robber's flesh, or something like that.
Yes. This is Darwish, and Darwish is really interesting. You know, he's really that first generation who lived through the Nakba but ended up in Israel.
Yeah.
Right. So Darwish is the Palestinian poet in a lot of ways. He's known not just in Palestine but all of the Arab world for his very powerful, especially his early poems. But he actually was fluent in Hebrew. He went to school in Hebrew. He fell in love with a Jewish woman. The stories about this woman he calls Rita and some of the poetry is a Jewish woman that he couldn't be with because neither one of their families would allow it. He knew Israeli culture inside and out, but he was Palestinian and he was unintimidated by that. You know, he wanted to speak for Palestine and the right of Palestinians, and he did so from his first book of poetry was published when he was 20, I think. And in some ways, that first book of poetry is very radical. I think the poem that you were talking about is Identity Card.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So this is, I'll be skipping around the poem to just read what I put in the book. Write down, I'm an Arab, and my identity card number is 50,000. I have 8 children, and the ninth is due after summer. Does this anger you? I do not hate people, nor do I steal. But if I become hungry, I will eat my robber's flesh. Beware then. Beware of my hunger and my anger.
I would like for you to, this might seem like a layup, but you've been teaching for quite a while and you have seen, like I think all professors in this space, a drastic change in your students and their interest in this, maybe their attitudes in this, maybe that famous Overton window that everyone talks about is blown wide open from when you started. Can you tell me how October 7th changed your classroom? Either perhaps your teaching, if you realize you're able to open up certain things you've never been able to say before, and maybe the students are just different, and maybe it's a bit of that hunger that Darwish was was referencing, because it's not just Palestinian hunger now, it's feeling like a global kind of hunger. Yeah.
I noticed the change starting before October 7th, definitely. And in fact, some of my friends and I had been talking before COVID, and we're talking about how the students were changing in their willingness to hear about Palestine, their sense of criticalness of Israel, the ways they understood that issue to be deeply connected to anti-colonialism that they were interested in their own lives. Part of the change has to do with the changing demographics, at least where I was teaching at George Washington University. It became a more multiracial, international student body over time. But it also has to do with the organizing work that people were doing here, and particularly the BDS movement, which I was not super in favor of at first. I thought it would really get us into trouble, basically, which, you know, it did. But what I under-respected or didn't realize was that it really gave people something to do, something nonviolent, something that wasn't requiring you to go out every Wednesday and Thursday night and join in a protest, but that actually people could organize around boycotting Soda Stream, for example, or you know, other kind of products from Israel, or having their academic institutions declare boycotts of working with Israeli state institutions, and so that brought it home to a lot of people and kind of ordinary people, not just academics. But I wasn't teaching in 23-24, I was on the fellowship, so I didn't see the immediate change in my students. I didn't have those conversations with students right then. I mean, I had them with faculty and with other people, but when I came back and was teaching the next year, it was like I was in a different place. I mean, I had been back in town. I was at GW the day of the first encampment began. I just happened to have been around, and then I knew it was happening, so I went down there. So I got to see the beginnings of the encampments, and no, there were a lot of American studies majors who were doing the encampments, not surprisingly. But when I came back and started teaching in fall 24, and I was teaching my U.S. in the World course, I was talking about a lot of things, not just related to Israel-Palestine at all. In fact, mostly, hardly any. But when we did talk about it, students were incredibly receptive and interested from the beginning, from the first day, in ways that had never happened. So in the first day when I teach this U.S. in the World course, I teach it as a course about the United States as an empire in the 20th century. It starts in 1898. And so I give them a lecture about different kinds of empire. Cultural empire, extractive empire, settler colonialism, blah, blah, blah. And I relate all of them to the United States. The first question I got on the first day, my first teaching in the fall of 24, somebody raises his hand and says, now in terms of settler colonialism, can both sides in a settler colonial situation be oppressed?
grad student. And I was like,
and I was like, here I am trying to subtly raise some points, and you immediately, sort of basically bring up Israel-Palestine. So it has been an extraordinary opportunity to teach during these moments, to teach at moments when students are very concerned to think. Again, they're sort of, I imagine they're like, I would have been wanting to get this right.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a moral issue as well as a political issue, or they are often intertwined. And trying to understand how not to be anti-Semitic, but how to be pro-Palestinian, and can they do that, and what does that mean? And in all sorts of fights about it with friends and other students and in classrooms. But the conversation is one in which, I mean, if pro-Israel students say they feel on the defensive in many situations, that's probably not wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not everywhere, but in places like GW, definitely the student population tends to be more receptive to a Palestinian narrative than I've ever seen, and probably at this point more receptive to a Palestinian narrative than an Israeli one. Now, that's not true at many places, and in many parts of the university it's not true. But it gets, I think that pro-Israel students are not accustomed to that. You know, the Palestinian students have had to defend who they are and every right, even the very idea of being a people who have rights, even being a people who are not liars from birth, people, actually defend themselves as moral human beings in the world. And that's been what they've had to do from time immemorial, basically. And so they, they know what that feels like, but I think a lot of the pro-Israel students have not ever experienced that before, having to be on the defensive, and they find that very uncomfortable.
With that being said, you said that they're receptive to Palestinian narratives more so than Israeli narratives. I imagine they're telling their own narratives as well, not just receiving, but they must be spinning it back to you. Are they surprising you in some ways of what they might want to do with this? Like your activist story, like you said, went through the two-state cross pin thing that everyone did. And I don't know if they're making the same kind of noises. You did write a little bit about stuff that's close to my heart of thinking in maybe, post-national ways and the nation state itself being maybe a flawed concept. But I guess I'm asking you as someone who's closer to these students, it's like, what are they doing with the conversation that maybe is surprising you or maybe making you feel uncomfortable?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because we don't, in my big, it's 50 students and sometimes it's 100 students, this U.S. in the World class, and sometimes even bigger. We don't. At some point, I was giving them part of the history of the 1967 war, and I was like, look, I'm not telling you what my plan for solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. If you want to come to my office and talk about that, we can, but what I am telling you is what happened in 1967. It's my perspective, of course, but there's not some secret behind there. I'm not trying to say, and therefore this proves that, because I really think it's too complicated for there to be these kind of simple moral lessons from one war or another. But the students, I think, are quite, one story we do have in that class is the ways in which after starting in the 1940s, a lot of conflicts were solved, quote solved, were handled by partitioning.
Yeah.
So we study, you know, Pakistan and India and Israel-Palestine, and then in 1967, we're not only studying the 1967 war, but we're also studying the 1967 civil war in Nigeria, where Biafra broke off as a separate state and was unsustainable as a separate state. And so it's not like every time they break off and make a state, and that goes really well. It's not like it's always a bad idea, but it definitely has been the logic of ethnic states to become smaller and smaller and smaller, right? More and more specific about who's involved or who's included in a particular state. And so I try to at least raise the possibility that ethnic states are, you know, a fantasy solution to a lot of things. And Biafra is actually, interestingly, a really good example, because the Igbo people in Biafra were, this is again, it's also happening in 1967, the two wars start within 3 weeks of each other. Everybody said, oh, we're going to make an Igbo state in Biafra, but there were 200 different ethnic groups in this tiny little place of Biafra, and a lot of them didn't like the Igbo domination. But, you know, Biafra was the size, I don't know, the size of North Carolina or something, so you couldn't really break it up to much smaller states. And so one of the things I do all semester implicitly is raise questions about the difference between self-determination and statehood. Like, could people, there are a lot of different ways to do self-determination. One of my friends actually just published a book about that. And there are a lot of different ways to think about governance that aren't always about putting your own ethnic group in a state and going from there. And I hope that helps them when the time comes to imagine another possibility for Israel-Palestine other than the ones that seem to be on the table, which seem to be, you know, a very difficult to achieve movement of peoples to make some kind of Palestinian and some kind of Israeli state. I think that's very difficult at this point. It was possible maybe back in the 80s, but I don't think a two-state solution is possible now.
Yeah.
But the other possibility seems to be, a state in which one or the other group is quite dominant, and of course it's most likely to be Israel. But as I used to say to a friend of mine, well, you know, it's one state, and right now it's Israel. In 50 years, it's going to be Palestine, because that's the way the numbers are going, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, my students are surprising me, but they aren't. So it's not like they are all sitting around going, you know, free, free Palestine, we hate Israel. That's not what they're doing. They're trying to think through how this could be solved in a way that doesn't ask anybody to leave their homes. And that's very, you know, I really appreciate their ethics around that. It's just very difficult to do.
Yeah. With the... that student who asked the question, it's so powerful of can both be oppressed, because that gets a lot of flack with people thinking that there's this very clean sever in the world of seeing it of oppressor and oppressed, and your job is to just figure out which one is which and then support the oppressed, and that's kind of the end of the end of politics and the end of ethics. I would like for you to react to that, of how you maybe, even yourself, try to complicate that picture when it comes to something like Israel-Palestine and your work. Or is that kind of the right way to look at it? You could even maybe fold in your, the title of this diary, this book that you put out.
Mm-hmm.
It's got the three promises, which seem to be trying to address this mess that we're in.
Well, I think that at one level, I don't see it as complicated. I do think the Israelis are oppressing the Palestinians, and that's the fundamental reality on the ground. And that has been the fundamental reality for a very long time, for many decades. We're in a moment where two things, impossible things, seem to be the case at the same time. One is that we might really, at one level, there's a push for Palestinian sovereignty, Palestinian state that we've never seen in my lifetime. And that possibility that that could actually happen seems, when you're in certain circles, seems just tangible. Even if it's not going to happen next week, it seems like the idea of Israel as a sanctified place that's doing everything right, has to be protected, has really been shattered by, even for a lot of, not people on the left, but just ordinary people who aren't even that political, are no longer feeling that great about Israel. So it being protected in the way that it has been by the United States, or having that kind of moral status, just seems over. But on the other hand, there's nothing that I see, nothing that anybody's doing that really seems to me to be at the big meta level, at the geostrategic political level, nation state level, is anybody doing anything to make a Palestine happen? It just feels to me like the disconnect between what people, ordinary people in Europe, in the Middle East, in the US, elsewhere think, and what their leaders are doing is stunning. And so we have a whole sea change in attitude, and at the same time, the European Union and the United States are rushing to help the Israelis solidify their control again over whatever parts of Gaza they want, again over the West Bank. They're moving. People are coming out of the settlements. They're taking land every single day. It looks to me like Palestine is being eaten alive at the same time. And so I don't feel super hopeful right now. I know that some people do, but I feel like we're seeing a lot of, I feel like, you know, there was a sea change in attitudes in the United States toward Native Americans just about the time that Native Americans became no longer politically powerful enough to make a real claim.
Yeah, when you start understanding the large systems potentially that are the engine behind the oppression of the Palestinians and many, many other people in the world, they're the focal point. I guess I'm asking this question of, like, because you lived through it from the previous generation, like, global revolution seems to sort of be in the air. And where do, in some ways I'm saying, how do we take the focus from Palestine to the world in order to free Palestine rather than ourselves? or is that a mistake? Or is it just hyper-focus on Palestine? Right. It's like, I don't even know how to formulate the question and the concern I have. But it feels like the world is fed up with what's happened to the Palestinians, but they know it's indicative of a global system. And your students must be feeling that too. It's no surprise to me that American history students are in the street.
And that the people who are South Asian or Latino or African in background now recognize fully that Palestine is the symbolic center of a struggle that they are also part of.
Yeah.
And so everybody understands that it's not because the only bad things in the world are happening in Palestine.
Yeah.
It's because some very bad things have been happening in Palestine, and they are happening in a way that is emblematic of and symbolic of the kind of struggle that is ongoing to create genuinely post-colonial societies, genuinely decolonial contexts that got rid of the formal colonial rule. That was the struggle against colonialism, but yet the structures of capitalism, the structures of racism, the ways that technology has been distributed, all of these things have meant that a lot of folks who are coming to GW come from countries that have remained poor, that have remained underdeveloped, that have remained without really functioning democracies. And so that sense that this is symbolic of all sorts of unkept promises, that the promises that I talk about in the book are, I talk about the three promises that were made to, you know, people in Israel, Palestine, but really there were a lot of promises that came out of Bandung, that came out of the anti-colonial struggle, a lot of dreams for a more genuinely equal world that was not built on oppression. It was also not built on extraction of one thing after another to the point of destroying the worlds that people might want to live in.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I talked about, I was just at the American Studies Conference, and I was on a panel called American Studies After Gaza.
Mm.
And I ended up talking, everybody had their own thing, but I ended up talking about a lot of comparisons between the Vietnam War and Gaza in terms of how they impacted their American audiences, so to speak, how they had influence in the United States. And one of the things I argued is that, you know, after Vietnam was the era of human rights, that, you know, before that there was, you know, a kind of liberal Americanism that basically got, American liberalism basically got destroyed in Vietnam, and after it came this kind of politics without politics. There's a human rights thing that says, we don't care if you're left, right, or center, there's just some things you shouldn't do, and we're going to stand up for that wherever we see it. And human rights, in that sense, it has a lot of good things going for it. But everyone has known, who's been paying attention, that it has been honored in the breach as much as in the protection of it, right? And that human rights are not equally protected. I mean, Hannah Arendt talked about this in the early 1960s, the right to have rights is not something that everybody has. And you see certain places where people get all worked up about human rights violations and certain places where they don't. So it's never been fully functioning, to say the least. It's been, you know, really a, what one person I know calls a thin tissue of human rights holding certain things together. But I really believe that even more than the war on terror, where the idea of human rights as a universal really took a battering with Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and rendition and all of that stuff, it didn't unfold. The war on terror and those terrible things that were happening that the United States was largely behind didn't unfold in front of our eyes the way that Gaza did, and it was over a much longer period of time. So I think it was Gaza that ended the human rights era. That the level of hypocrisy, violence, double talk, invisibility. I mean, for those of us who were watching, we saw people, we saw this happening in front of us on YouTube or on Instagram. But many people didn't even know, didn't even see. It was hidden from them. But nonetheless, people knew that violence was happening, that mass killing was happening, and there was an uprising and a worldwide kind of speaking out against it, and yet nothing stopped it. And I think that that has ended for us any ability to claim human rights as a politics.
Yeah.
And so we ended up talking, well, what comes next? And I said, we actually kind of know what comes next. What comes next has to be a planetary consciousness.
Mm.
It has to be a planetary consciousness that includes the non-human. It has to have an ecology at its base about living in a sustainable way. And it has to take seriously the lives of non-human beings, of the Earth, all of that stuff. Because we're at a moment when the kind of logic of the late 20th century, early 21st century that imagined that, or tried to imagine that after the Cold War, we were going to work this out through some kind of, you know, universal state and human rights being a part of that, just failed. It just failed tremendously.
Yeah. I mean, is that the end of the UN? Of the, like, I always think of this as a historian, like you think of, it's there's kind of an obvious punctuation mark where you have a global system getting itself in trouble with empires, then having a massive world war, and everyone's like, man, that was really bad. I don't want to do that again. Let's get together and make a table. We'll call it the League of Nations. Oh, it's pretty flawed. That failed pretty quickly. And then we have another even more massive fight. Oh, that was really bad. Let's get together and have a table, not do it again. We'll call this one the United Nations. And it's, people could fill in the blank of the next sentence of that, which it seems to be like, we can go one of two ways right here, because I mean, I think that's incredible.
The United Nations, the first thing it did was the UN Declaration of Human Rights, right? Those two things are intimately intertwined.
And almost its first act was to create Israel-Palestine, and literally the thing that will, it's like the test of the United Nations.
I think that it's quite clear to me that the United Nations has no chance of being an effective arbiter of world anything. They have done some important things. They really have. The UN military forces that have sometimes gone in between fighting powers have been very important. It's not been, you know, a terrible idea at one level, but at another level, it has been so useless in so many ways. And again, I, you know, one of the reasons that I still believe that the Israelis can and should have the right to have some kind of self-determination in the territory that they're in. Self-determination may be meaning voting members of a multinational state, or it may be whatever it means, is that the UN did found Israel. And as much as that was deeply problematic, and in fact, I think an immoral decision, I know why they made it, I know why they felt like it was the right thing to do, but it's all we had. Like, so if you either you say that what the UN did in these periods we have to live with and build from, or you ignore it altogether, and then there's no standard or structure we can work from to say where do we land on how international conflicts can be resolved. If we're going to start quoting UN resolution X or Y or Z, we have to think about what we mean by abiding by what the UN says.
I'm going to ask.
I would say ultimately I land on a flawed idea. And I think that ultimately we're going to have something very different. I wish to God I was the person who could tell you what that would be and could, you know, save the world that way. But I'm not quite sure.
I'm a traveler, just as they were, walking the world, thinking of the past, on an earth so vast, waiting to return. Just to know you, whoever you are, laugh with you, learn from you, open to you my heart. But soon when I say goodbye and move on, I'm a traveler just as they were, walking the world, thinking of the past on an earth so vast, waiting to return.
traveler, just as they were walking the world, thinking of the past on an earth so vast, waiting to return, waiting to return.
We have to have a very fair assessment of this academic and intellectual icon of early Islam.
His impact is more pronounced in jurisprudence that he formalized.
And tens of thousands of statements and teachings have reached us from Al-Imam al-Sadr alayhi salam.
This is Dialogue, an introduction to the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today, we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the history of Islam, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. The sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, was an incredibly prominent character in the history of the Muslims. He benefited humankind with his highly scientific achievements, many of which had never been seen before by humanity. Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam's instructions in the acts of worship and transactions and his contribution in the field of legislation were amazing achievements that had not occurred before amongst the Muslim masses.